Coffee with Cudmore.
Light 104.7 and 1570 AM WVTL.
We welcome Montgomery County historian Kelly Farquhar to the program. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning.
Kelly Farquhar and a group of historians have been working on African American history in New York's Montgomery County, in particular an era in the 1800s, Kelly?
Yes. We're focusing on between 1820 and 1890 right now.
Why is that?
Well, that seemed to be the time when, you know, there was a shift between the abolition of slavery in New York State, which was in 1827, but there was still slavery in the South, so we were trying to see what African Americans there were possibly living in Montgomery County that could have been freedom seekers coming up from the South.
Mm-hmm. And that's commonly called the Underground Railroad, although it wasn't really a railroad with tracks and so forth.
No, it wasn't. It was just a metaphor. You know, there seems to be a misconception that the term Underground Railroad referred to underground tunnels, but it was more that it was a, you know, the term underground meant it was more like a secret network of individuals who were working together to assist people escaping slavery to freedom.
Mm-hmm. Maybe more on that in a moment, because I don't believe this next question figures into that, but maybe it does. I like stories, and one of the stories you told me early on, in fact, I even put it in my book, about Chester Hoke, who lived in Canajoharie, a black man who ended up going into the Civil War.
Yes, yes. He served in the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, which was the subject of the movie Glory. And it was one of the first African-American regiments that was put together. And he served when he was about 17 years old.
Hmm. And then came back to Canajoharie and pretty much lived out his life there.
Correct. Yeah, he was a native of Canajoharie. He lived there all of his life except for when he was in the Civil War, and came back to Canajoharie after the war and married, you know, rather later in life. He was in his 40s when he married. He was a porter for the Nellis Hotel. And his wife, before their marriage, she had worked for the Arkell family.
Hmm. Was the Nellis Hotel in Canajoharie?
Yes, it was.
Hmm. And he became well-known. I mean, in fact, I don't want to go too far afield with it, but I think I did send to you, and I don't know if you've gotten ever into, there was a porter in Amsterdam, an African-American porter named Dixie Veal, who became very well-known in Amsterdam because he interacted a lot with white folks, in all honesty. I mean, you know, taking their luggage and so forth, and, you know, again, became well-known in Amsterdam. And I presume that the same happened to Chester Hoke?
Yeah, it seems that he was very well-liked and well-respected within the community. He also served in the Faro Post of the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the local GAR chapter. And, yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, he was very well-respected. His son lived until 1989, one of his sons, and he was he ran a taxi service. Mm-hmm. Right there in Canajoharie, and every time I mentioned to, you know, some people the name Hoke, they said, I remember Bob Hoke ran the taxi.
And his name was Bob Hoke.
His name was Bob Hoke.
It sounds like we're talking about Bob Hope, but it's
right.
Bob Hoke.
Now, no, Hoke, H-O-K-E.
H-O-K-E. Now, his house, Bromley, in fact, he was called Bromley, right, Chester Bromley?
He was called Bromley, yes.
For some reason. Was that, do you know the reason why he was called Bromley? Is that his middle name, or...
That was his middle name, and I believe there was a white man living in Canajoharie named Chester Bromley.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very possibly named after this individual. You know, we don't know a whole lot about Bromley's early life, except for the fact that he seemed to have been raised by his grandparents, who both had been former slaves.
Mm-hmm. And would the presumption, I mean, the possibility be that Bromley owned them, or, you know, the original Bromley?
No, actually. The grandmother, her name was Maria, and she was owned by the Garlock family. Hmm. And the grandfather, Henry Miller, he was owned by a farmer named John Miller in Fort Plain.
Isn't that something? I get stuck on that sometimes when you start talking about black history, African-American history. But then you get to that sentence construction, you know, Garlock owned the ancestor of Bromley Hoke. It just
it does
make it more real somehow. That's really the way it was. Like, you know, somebody owned a horse or something like that.
Yeah, that's the way it was. When Maria Miller, Bromley Hoke's grandmother, passed away in 1890, I think it was 1892 or 93, her obituary stated that she had been owned.
Now, and also, other interesting thing, Chester Bromley Hoke's house is still there.
It's still there, yes. It's in Canjoharie, and it's on Mohawk Street. And, you know, it's been vacant for quite some time, and the owner is, you know, trying to do some work on it to fix the place up. And, you know, once he found out that the history, I mean, I think he had an idea of the history before, but I don't think he realized how significant it was. And once he realized it, you know, he and I have been working together, and he's really enthusiastic about trying to rehab the place and seeing what he can do to save it.
And is there is a marker there, isn't there, or no?
Yes, there is a marker with his permission. Our Heritage and Genealogical Society put up a marker last year to, you know, identify that as the spot where Chester Bromley Hoke lived.
Now, if you permit me a little story, I think I sent it to you, but I found out about Dixie Veal visiting some folks down in, went down to the old fort in Schoharie, and he was known down there. He came from there, but Dixie Veal was a black man who was a slave in Georgia, and when Sherman's army was marching through, he hooked up with them, and in particular with an upstate unit, I think down in from Schoharie County. So he came up here, ended up being a porter at the hotels in Amsterdam, or a hotel in Amsterdam. Lived, I want to say, on Walnut Street. But what I thought was the most fascinating story about Dixie Veal, that was his nickname, honestly. I can't remember his real name.
Yeah, I think it was like Anthony or something, but I don't remember exactly.
But according to one of the newspaper accounts, and it was written in a, you know, kind of flowery way as you would write it then, but I believe it shows you the respect he had. This hotel had, the opera house had entertainment, and often including minstrel shows, you know, white performers dressing in blackface. And one of the performers came and was going to satirize Dixie Veal specifically, because, you know, he was so well known. And Dixie Veal didn't like that. And he told the guy he didn't want that done, and the hotel backed him up, said, "Don't do that. You know, Mr. Veal doesn't want it done."
Well, that was very, you know, very good of the hotel officials. Because I think that you know, some people just kind of pass that off as, oh, well, that's just, you know,
yeah, having fun. And yeah. Veal said, "No, I don't think it's funny."
Yeah.
You know, I suppose the guy did other black characters, but he didn't do Dixie Veal.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we have found in this research, for all of the African-Americans that lived in this area, there still was a sense of prejudice, you know, for some people. There was a gentleman who was touring through the area, and he was, you know, giving lectures, and there was a letter that he had written to an abolitionist, and he talked about when he stopped at this one inn in Fort Plain. He went to sit down and eat when the meal bell was called, and the tavern owners, you know, indicated, you know, "You can't sit here. You have to go eat in a separate area." And they said, "We're not abolitionists here."
Now, but speaking of abolitionists, and by the way, we're talking with Kelly Farquhar about her project, maybe more on the project in a moment, but I do like to hear the stories. Speaking of abolitionists, you've looked into the case of, and I can't remember his first name, of one of the Clisbys. Yeah, it's a well-known name in Amsterdam to this day because there's a Clisby Avenue. He was a white guy, and he was an early abolitionist?
Yes, his name was Ellis Clisby, and he lived in Amsterdam, you know, he with his whole family. He actually was part of the organization of the Montgomery County Anti-Slavery Society in the 1830s, and he was also part of a group called the Eastern New York Anti-Slavery Society. And Alessa Wiley at Fort Johnson, she had found newspaper articles that they had in their files that had been written about Ellis Cliveby and his abolitionist activity. Apparently, there was some dissension in the Presbyterian Church, and he left it for a while because of the issues of slavery. And I think he attended a church either down in Schenectady, or I think he actually went to Massachusetts for some time. He returned to the area, but he was a very staunch abolitionist, and there were reports that people were coming up on the train, freedom seekers, and they were going to Ellis Cliveby's house and staying there. You know, there was another guy in Amsterdam that we have found. His name was Chandler Bartlett, and he owned a shoe store right there in downtown Amsterdam from, like, the 1820s. And they either would go to his store or his house and then on to Ellis Cliveby's, and then from there they would, you know, make their way to Canada.
Mm-hmm. I have to look about Ellis Cliveby, because I've been doing this contest. People have been sending me stories. Mm-hmm. And I want to say his name is Bob Johnson, who lives in the town of Amsterdam and is interested in that part of the area. Mm-hmm. And he sent me a story about somebody named Cliveby, but maybe the timing's not right for it to be Ellis, but it was back in the 1790s. He was disciplined by the Presbyterian Church for working on the Sabbath. I wonder if maybe it was, you know, if it were Ellis, I wonder if, you know, it's, you know, he's disciplined for that reason, but maybe they were trying to get at him for other things.
That could have been his father.
Okay.
His father was Joseph Cliveby, and he was also involved in the anti-slavery movement, from what we can gather.
Because what Bob said was, these were newspaper accounts that he looked up, and that it was pretty strict. You know, what happened, you know, the charge was he worked on the Sabbath, and I don't know, he had to give up his post on the Board of Trustees, or he couldn't go to church for, I don't know, different things that they made him do.
Yeah, I mean, the church was the pinnacle of your social life.
Sure.
You know, outside of work, so they were pretty rigid with what could be done and what couldn't be done.